The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live from Studio Winterfell. I'm so happy to be here with you on this beginning of the 4th of July weekend. It's the first day of July, rabbit. But I am happy because yesterday the Supreme Court dealt a decision, West Virginia versus EPA, more significant in my view than the Dobbs case for long-term freedom in the United States. Of course, the Dobbs case means many more unborn babies will be born, but it does not mean that freedom will be guaranteed. And I think that West Virginia versus EPA is an enormously important decision for rescuing us from the administrative state. More on a moment. Headlines first. Yair Lapid is Israel's 14th prime minister. He took over after the Knesset dissolved under a previous agreement with Naftali Bennett, who announced his retirement. They're going to elections on November 1st in Israel. I expect Netanyahu to be the next prime minister, but we got a caretaker in Yair Lapid, and caretakers get to be president for long or short. Xi Jinping insisted yesterday in a visit to Hong Kong that Hong Kong must be governed by, quote, patriots. It was the 25th anniversary of Margaret Thatcher's biggest mistake, getting Hong Kong back to the communist Chinese, who have, of course, repressed it. President Biden has chided the court for its Dobbs decision, called for the ending of the filibuster. Now, he's done this before. He said, let's end the filibuster, but just for voting rights. Now, let's just end the filibuster, but just for abortion rights. If you end the filibuster for anything, it's over for everything. That's the rule. That's the same thing that Harry Reid did. And by the way, I'd like to thank the late Harry Reid and all of his staff and supporters who are listening this morning for the decisions of this, the most significant term in the Supreme Court's history in my lifetime. And quite possibly at least since 1935-36. And I think forever, actually, this EPA decision yesterday was huge. Moreover, the Supreme Court indicated it's going to hear a case on the state legislature's power over elections. That can't come soon enough. They've got to get redistricting out of these independent commissions, which have no basis in the Constitution. And I believe the original six will, in fact, hit that. Now, let me go to this decision yesterday. You know, Barack Obama tried to get two big pieces of legislation passed in 2009-2010 when he had supermajority of 60 in the Senate and in the House. He picked the Affordable Health Care Act, and the Obamacare was priority number one, and it got barely through before Ted Kennedy died, threw everything, and Scott Brown was elected. He chose not to advance the statutory authority for EPA to regulate climate change via the control of all emissions. That's not in the Clean Air Act 1 or the Clean Air Act 2.0. It's not there. So then he said, well, I've got a pen and a phone, and I'm going to just demand my EPA director, then Gina McCarthy, who's now over at the White House as a senior client. She's crying all night long. She's been crying about this, and said, go forward and do the Clean Power Plan anyway. And they did. They began to regulate it. And then Scott Pruitt arrived at the EPA, and the former EPA director said no and revoked the rule. And then his successor, Andrew Wheeler, said, no, we really mean it, and put out a new rule. And then arrives Joe Biden, and they say, no, we're going back to the Obama days. And they brought in a new EPA director to try and grab control of all of American industry, especially coal. And yesterday, in a 6-3 decision, West Virginia versus EPA, that I'll be teaching for a year. Maybe the first thing I will teach them, maybe the first thing I will tell my students is a short course in constitutional law is this. In 1776, the 13 colonies banded together to declare their independence from Great Britain, and they fought a 6-year war and succeeded at Yorktown in breaking free of the mother country. They all had their own state and constitutions, and they had the Articles of Confederation, which did not work. So they dispatched delegates to Philadelphia in 1787 to come up with something better. And those delegates closed the doors and shuttered the windows and operated in absolute secrecy from May until, I believe, September, and issued the United States Constitution, which was then sent to the delegates of all the state conventions that in turn ratified it. So it's ratified by the people, not by the state legislatures. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. That constitution immediately had to be amended by 10 amendments in order to secure votes of people who were concerned that individual freedoms like the Second Amendment and the First Amendment and the Sixth Amendment were not, and the Fifth Amendment's prohibition against taking without just compensation, that should come up next year. They had to argue. It was a close-run thing. They barely got it passed. But when they got it passed, it became the law of the land and remained largely unchanged until 1868, when the 14th Amendment was passed in the aftermath of the Civil War. The original defect that allowed for slavery to exist in the United States was struck from the Constitution via the 13th Amendment. There is no slavery anymore in the United States, but the 14th Amendment was the one that guaranteed the newly freed former slaves every benefit of citizenship. Along comes the right to vote for women, and all of a sudden, by 1920, though it has to work itself out, it takes decades to get the full freedom. All Americans alike, all citizens alike. And by the way, the Congress is in charge of limited and enumerated powers to do a few things. Doesn't get to do everything that it wants. It gets to do a few things. One of those things is that if it wants, it can set up agencies. But when it sets up agencies, it's got to give them some idea what to do. That used to be called the non-delegation doctrine. It's now called the major questions doctrine. And yesterday it got 6 votes. The long and the short of it is the Chief Justice for all 6 and Justice Gorsuch in a particularly poignant concurrence. But the Chief Justice in a memorable case says to the EPA, wait a minute, you don't get to make it up. You don't get to grab a little bit of the statute here, or a little bit of the statute there, put them all together and infer from these various parcels of the statute. And the Clean Air Act is very long and the Clean Air Act amendments are very long and complex. The Clean Air Act was signed by Richard Nixon. The Clean Air Act amendments were signed by George H.W. Bush. Conservative Republicans, center-right Republicans, call them what you want. They were not administrative straight junkies like Woodrow Wilson, who, by the way, came in for a scalding footnote. Jonah, if you're listening this morning, you're going to love, Jonah Goldberg wrote a great book about Wilson called Liberal Fascism. And it's all about how Woodrow Wilson's just a nut job. And over in the Gorsuch concurrence on page 4, he writes about, from time to time, some people have questioned the assertion that the framers believed a republic would be more likely to enact more just laws than a regime administered by a ruling class of largely unaccountable ministers. Justice Gorsuch drops footnote 1 in the Gorsuch concurrence. It might be famous, footnote 1. For example, Woodrow Wilson famously argued that, quote, popular sovereignty embarrassed the nation because it made it harder to achieve executive expertise. In Wilson's eyes, the mass of the people were selfish, ignorant, timid, stupid, stubborn, or foolish. He expressed even greater disdain for particular groups, defending the white men of the South for ridding themselves by fair means or foul of the intolerable burden of government sustained by the votes of ignorant African Americans. And that's in blacks. Woodrow Wilson really despised black people. I hope you know that. Wilson likewise denounced, this is Gorsuch again, Wilson likewise denounced immigrants from the, quote, south of Italy and men of the meaner sort out of Hungary and Poland, who possessed neither skill nor energy nor any initiative of quick intelligence. To Wilson, our republic tried to do too much by the vote. I love that Gorsuch slams down Woodrow Wilson. He also slams down Barack Obama. At the very end, Gorsuch writes, when Congress seems slow to solve problems, it may be only natural that those in the executive branch might seek to take matters into their own hands. But the Constitution does not authorize agencies to use pen and phone regulations, smack, smack, as substitutes for laws passed by the people's representatives. In our republic, Gorsuch writes, it is the peculiar province of the legislature to prescribe general rules for the government of society. Fletcher v. Peck, 1810, because today's decision helps safeguard that foundational constitutional premise, I am pleased to concur. Now, I'm going to come back after the break and read you the Chief Justice's rather longer and more complex, but very crucial opinion. Understand, 2 huge things happened yesterday. The Constitution was restored and bureaucrats were blown backwards, and the Big Ten inexplicably admitted the University of Southern California and UCLA down the road. That means when the bands compete, we are going to have the USC band without trumpets. And I don't even know if UCLA plays sports at the Big Ten level. Do they have a football team in UCLA? I'm not sure. John Andrazic can tell us. But I'm here to tell you the Big 14 is going to be like the SEC of the North and the civilized lands versus the SEC, which is just, you know, football teams around which students congregate. The real universities up north and out west are going to play all together. Bruins and Trojans joining the Buckeyes. That gives the Buckeyes a couple of wins every year for sure. But I'm here to tell you, more importantly, West Virginia versus EPA concludes the most significant term in my lifetime on the Supreme Court. And what a great term it was. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That's Elvis, of course, and probably the only Elvis recording that actually was a hit, an original hit, in my youth. The one that came out when I was lifeguarding years, 1974 through 1977. So as I watched Elvis with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt yesterday, I kept waiting for it. And you finally get it. You finally get it at the end. You finally get a lot in this movie, but I'm going to turn over the analysis to our resident movie critic, Sonny Bunch, because for the first time, I think ever, the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I have seen a movie as Sonny reviews it. So, Sonny, welcome. Tell the audience what I think it's going to do very well in box offices this long weekend, 4th of July. What about Elvis?
All right. So, Elvis, the thing here's, I want to just set the stage for folks. I want to temper expectations, because Elvis is not a musical biopic. Right. Elvis is not your stand. It's not like Walk the Line or Ray. Right. It is not a musical biopic.
It's a lot more like Rocket Man, if you ask me. Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic.
Right.
Go ahead.
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. But even that is still kind of hewed to the musical biopic formula. This is not a musical biopic. This is a superhero movie. This is a piece of American mythology. This is creating the idea of Elvis, recreating the idea of Elvis, the ideal, the impact he had on the country. And it's not really about the life of Elvis or the man Elvis. It's about the myth, the superhero. And the movie is not subtle about this, right? Early on, Hugh, you'll remember there's a sequence of him as a kid. He's running around and he's got the big Shazam lightning bolt around his neck, right? Yeah. And he's running between essentially what a juke joint whorehouse type place and a revival church, and he's getting the sacred and the profane, right? Again, not a subtle movie. He's getting the sacred and the profane that will come to define rock and roll. Right. Both the
and he's getting the African-American experience transferred to white culture.
Right. And he is absorbing the African-American experience. Of course, he grew up in African-American neighborhoods. He was enamored of African-American culture, clothing, cars, that sort of thing. And he would kind of absorb all of that and turn it into something that was enormously popular among the rest of the country, among the white portion of the country. So that's what you have to keep in mind when you're watching this. And stylistically, it is very much like a superhero movie, and not like an MCU superhero movie. I'm saying it's closer to, I don't know, something like a Zack Snyder movie, in that it's very stylized. It is made by Baz Luhrmann, who, if you've seen the rest of his movies, you'll know what I'm talking about. He made the relatively recent, 10 years ago, Great Gatsby adaptation with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. He made Moulin Rouge, a movie that just makes my teeth hurt just thinking about it. I am not a huge fan of Baz Luhrmann. I never have been before this, because I think his hyperkinetic style, his quick cuts, his rapid camera moves, his montages that are almost hallucinatory in effect, didn't really work for me.
One thing in this movie, the wandering through the casino bits, they didn't need. But I want to cover three things for sure with you. Austin Butler, who I was amazed by. Tom Hanks, who I think has been rightly applauded in some circles and blasted in others, and I found it to be a pretty interesting performance. And then Elvis himself. So let's start with Austin Butler. The kid can dance and sing.
He is a revelation in this. I mean, he's really fantastic. He's going to get a lot of Oscar buzz. He's going to deserve it because it is not, this is not a mere impersonation of Elvis. This is not, you know, sometimes in these biopics, you get somebody like Rami Malek doing the lead singer from Queen, right? And you know, his Freddie Mercury was fine, but it was an impression. Yes. This is more, this is a fully lived, fully embodied performance. There is a, there's a real idea behind what he's trying to do here. And I think it, it's just amazing. And you're right, he can move. I mean, he can dance. He can, you know, I guess he's singing. I don't want
to. It's as close to the real Elvis as anyone my age and certainly your age, because Elvis is 15 years before me. He is impacting American culture. And we get the after effect. Once when my apartment was broken into San Clemente, I had to walk across the street to borrow a phone, so I wouldn't distrust the fingerprint. And I walked into a shrine to Elvis by a lady who's about 15 years older. I mean, everything. Elvis, you know, jugs, Elvis pictures, Elvis blacklight painting. I mean, he did change America.
Yeah, and this is one thing that the movie really gets for me as somebody who has always been Elvis agnostic. I mean, he's
you and me both.
A talented musician and, you know, great singer. I knew all of this intellectually. But this movie gets, and again, this is part of the mythology of what the movie is trying to get across, what it is trying to present about Elvis, the kind of American god, right, is like how impactful he was, how much he changed, you know, the way people thought about music. And this movie gets that across for me. Finally, I finally get Elvis now in a very real way.
Now let's go to Tom Hanks, America's most beloved actor. I'm not going to rank him, but I'm going to say with some confidence, he is America's most beloved actor, and he's a villain.
Yeah, him and Denzel, like number one and number two. I would say so. Tom Hanks is interesting in this, and he's interesting in ways that the movie is interesting. So I've heard people complain about the way this movie centers Tom Parker. Basically, the way the movie is built, the framing device is Colonel Tom Parker is on his deathbed, and he is essentially complaining that he has been treated as a villain in the Elvis Presley story, that he's blamed for his death, and that he's called thief and told that, you know, he's been stealing from Elvis all these years. And the way the film is kind of structured is Tom Parker says, no, I'm not a villain. I'm just a normal guy like you. I'm also great like Elvis. And it's structured, again, this isn't a musical biopic superhero movie, but the way that Tom Parker is used here, it reminded me of Amadeus. The movie Amadeus.
Salieri.
He is essentially Salieri here. He's the normal guy through whom Elvis's greatness is reflected, right? You need that Salieri character to understand just how amazing.
But one difference.
Elvis really is.
Mozart did not depend. There would have been a Mozart whether or not there was a Salieri. There would not have been an Elvis but for Colonel Tom Parker. And this is the sort of movie where we're looking up in Wikipedia afterwards exactly what he did and when he did it. But I think it's the necessary but not sufficient cause of Elvis is Parker.
Sure. And look, every musician needs a manager and a promoter, right? Like every artist needs an agent, you know, in Hollywood. Everybody needs that guy behind the scenes. But the difference between, you know, a good guy behind the scenes and a bad guy behind the scenes is the difference between, you know, a Tom Parker and an agent you've never heard of. Because he thinks of himself as the equal to Elvis. He's the snowman, right? That's what he calls himself. I'm the snowman. I'm shaking all of the snow out of their pockets to make their money. And instead of the showman who is Elvis. But like, again, you have with the contrast that this movie gives us, we can see how just totally absurd this is. I mean, Elvis is a superhuman figure in this. He is a force of nature, and Tom Hanks is Colonel Parker is a scheming little man. He's a grotesque compared to.
And Elvis had already made it to Sun Records. The argument against my proposition is he'd already made it to Sun Records when Tom Parker heard about him. So let's go back to Elvis. At the end of this movie, Do Americans understand better? Do moviegoers understand? Will the Chinese release understand better America? And what will African Americans think about this?
You know, it's interesting. I'll deal with the last question second. The movie has a very funny scene early on that feels like it was written by a sociology undergrad, where they're talking about how it's very early. It's before any of the promoters had met Elvis, right? It's before Tom Parker had met Elvis. He just hears the album and he says, "Well, we can never have this black fellow on tour with us. This would not be, you know, we couldn't go to the places we'd want to go and play." And somebody else says, "No, but that's the thing. He's not black. He's white." And then everybody else in the group starts whispering, "He's white. He's white." And it is like, again, it's like how a sociology undergrad would handle cultural appropriation as a concept, as a dramatic concept, in this picture. But I do think there is, I think there is something, the unsubtlety is part of the myth building, and it does kind of help drive home that, you know, Elvis was succeeding where other people who were making similar music but were of the wrong, you know, quote unquote wrong race, would not have been able to succeed.
And it features black music, quite a lot of great black music. I got to close with this question, Sonny. We made the mistake of seeing it in an idiosyncratic theater, because I am way north, up in Studio Winterfell, and there's only so many theaters. There is no IMAX available. I wish I had seen this in an IMAX. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know if it was on IMAX, but it was in the Dolby.
That's what I mean.
Dolby Atmos, yeah. Type theaters, which I would have liked to have seen it there too. I saw it at in kind of just a regular Alamo Drafthouse theater, which was fine. I mean, it's still nice and big and loud, but it's definitely the sort of movie I would have liked to have heard. Specifically in an Atmos theater.
That's it. Especially the closing credits over that late hit, his last hit, Born in the Ghetto. It's kind of a haunting movie. I think it will do very, very well because it will, I think, appeal to young people. What do you think?
Well, it has already done better than expectations. Put it that way. It grossed $32 million in its opening weekend. And the reason it was able to do that was because it attracted older audiences who have stayed away from the theaters these last few months, or last few years, really, since the pandemic started. I think 61% of the audience was over the age of 35. Now, I'm over the age of 35. That makes me old, you know, but
I'm 66, but I'm still younger than an Elvis crowd. But I went to
according to the Hollywood, you know, counting metrics, we're both very old, Hugh. So, you know, it brought out older audiences, but I think you're right. I think it'll play with younger audiences again, because of stylistically, this is something more akin to a movie that they have been going to see with comic book trappings, right?
Wait for Austin Butler. Austin Butler is going to rise and rise and rise. Sonny Bunch, great review at the Bulwark. Watch Sonny always, or listen to Sonny at Across the Movie Aisle, his podcast, and Bulwark Goes to the Movie. Go read his review, which I linked at Twitter. And thank you, Sonny Bunch, at Sonny Bunch on Twitter. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Studio Winterfell in the far north, way, way north, headed to down east in Maine. I'm so glad to have with me Admiral James Stavridis this morning, because as I said last hour, this is the most significant week in the Constitution development and the Supreme Court of my life. And I've been teaching con law for 25 years, but I think it might also be the most significant week in the life of NATO since it got going. And we have the former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO here, James Stavridis. Admiral Stavridis, welcome. Am I overstating how big this week was for NATO?
Not at all. Biggest week since the collapse of the Soviet Union would be the way to think about this. So NATO, created in 1949, goes through a long, dark, cold war. We almost go to war with the Soviet Union along the Fulda Gap in Europe several times. Ultimately, the Soviet Union collapses. That is a huge moment for NATO and a moment of decision. Do you keep this alliance? Do you let it go? Its mission, is it over or not? Well, we now have the definitive answer to that in the form of the aggressive behavior in Vladimir Putin. And that brings us to this week. New strategic concept, Finland and Sweden joining NATO, and above all, this ongoing updraft in defense spending. When you put those three things together, it's an extraordinary week for NATO. It's a good week in Europe to have that NATO membership ticket.
Let me talk a little bit about the specifics of the United States' new commitment, have you comment, and then we'll come back to what it means generally. The United States agreed to open a base in Poland with 10,500 American service people stationed there. They agreed to additional troops deployed to Romania on a rotating basis. They agreed to send two new F-35 squadrons to the United Kingdom to bolster defense capabilities in Germany and Italy and to improve naval operations out of Rota. So as America's commitment to NATO goes, what do those four or five discrete moves mean to you, Admiral?
They're huge. And I think about my successor as Supreme Allied Commander, General Todd Walters, who was just relieved by General Chris Cavoli. Remember that name, fluent Russian speaker like General Shalishkashvili many years ago as Supreme Allied Commander, an extraordinary officer. He now has even more tools at his disposal than I did. And I was commanding during a period in which we were forward deployed in Afghanistan with 150,000 troops under my command. Chris now has comparable level of command focused on Russia. And by the way, we didn't just improve naval operations in Rota Hue. We added two more guided missile destroyers there to bring that to a total of six, a full destroyer squadron. One other point you didn't mention that I think is very significant, at that base in Poland will be permanently stationed a three-star general headquarters, 5th Corps. That gives Chris Cavoli, a very experienced three-star Army ground officer, he can turn to manage all those forward forces. So I think these are all smart moves in the face of aggression by Vladimir Putin.
So I got former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien on the phone, and I don't think he'd mind me relaying to you what we talked about. We're good friends. I know you know him well as well. He said, look, the two big things for NATO is that Finland's got a standing army of 60,000 ready and highly trained troops, as well as 160,000 territorials who are trained and close at hand on the border with Russia. And Sweden has the finest fleet of submarines not in the United States. Now, I don't know if you want to go that far, because Singapore's got good ones and Australia's got good ones. What do you think of those two things that immediately came to Ambassador O'Brien, former National Security Advisor, his assessment of the big takeaways?
Good points. I'm going to add to them slightly. In addition to the troop numbers you mentioned, there are probably another couple of 100,000 Finns who are well-trained, drill on a regular basis. It's a nation devoted to the idea of conscription. And here's the significant point, a nation who went through hell fighting the Russians in 1939. Their elders in that society remember very well what it is like to go to war with Russia. That's why they take it so seriously. Point two that I would add to the ambassador's comments, it provides a long border to the north that flanks the Russian military. And yeah, we got to defend it, but we've got the capacity to do so. What it means for Vladimir Putin, if he wants to counter those forces, he's got to put Russian troops up there. And guess what? Those troops can't be attacking Ukraine. It further dilutes his forces. And if he is crazy enough to try and attack, say, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, he's flanked to the north now by that new Finnish-Swedish border. It just complicates everything for Russia. So to his summary, I would add, geography has a power of its own here. And finally, the Swedes have great naval capacity, but I'd also point to their aviation. The Gripen fighter is absolutely an equivalent for our very fine FNA-18 Hornet, and they know how to fly them. They did things with those Gripens in the war over Libya that I didn't think you could do with an airplane. They are remarkable. So a big, big day for NATO.
So, Admiral, I asked Mike Gallagher, Congressman on the Armed Services Committee, Intel Committee, earlier this week, whether NATO ought to become NAPTO, not the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but the North Atlantic Pacific Treaty Organization. And he talked about how there's some differences, but do you expect to see, for example, Swedish submarines operating in the South China Sea?
That's a long way for a diesel boat to go. But I will say this, at the NATO summit for observer nations, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, also those Pacific nations, and by the way, Singapore couldn't be closer to many of the NATO nations, many of those Pacific nations deployed troops to Afghanistan alongside NATO. So there's real history. There's real connective tissue. I think it's premature to be talking about NAPTO, although I love acronyms as much as anybody. But certainly there is going to be an ongoing NATO presence in the South China Sea, more likely destroyers, nuclear submarines from the French and the British. Certainly continuing American patrols, they'll be augmented by the Pacific nations we just talked about.
Now, Admiral, I have the Hewitt corollary to the general rule that the Afghanistan collapse was a disaster for American proposition. Hewitt corollary was, we had 20 years of interoperability in Afghanistan, which really proved the concept of NATO and joint force operation under United States American command. It was a very costly lesson, but we've got that lesson deeply in our bloodstream. What do you think about that proposition?
It's absolutely accurate. And by the way, interoperability is a terrific word. It implies the communications work together. Our cyber is interneted. Our command and control is put in place. But the other word is all of these armies were blooded in Afghanistan. They fought. They saw their shipmates die alongside them. The colonels who fought in those operations, in those forever wars, are now the generals who command these armies. Same with the admirals. And this is now a very experienced warfighting force in combat. And you put that alongside the corollary you indicate, that interconnection, command and control, the high tech, all of that, the intelligence. That's a very formidable force. I, again, do not see Vladimir Putin taking on NATO. I think we have the strongest deterrent you can imagine.
So my last question is about the sunk costs that now burden Vladimir Putin. It is an important principle of life that you sever sunk costs because they're gone. You can't get it back. He has a lot of sunk costs in the Ukraine adventure now. Does he wake up or does he double down on disaster, in your opinion, Admiral?
He will double down on disaster and call it a victory. And what I mean by that is he will consolidate control in the southeast, hunker down, shoot for a Korean War scenario ending where he can turn around to the Russian people and falsely say, oh, I did everything I set out to do here. We all know he set out to conquer the entire country, put a puppet regime in Kyiv. He ended up with, at best, 20%. You know, any test I took at Annapolis, if I got a 20% on it, I failed it. And I think that's reality. He'll try and sell that to the Russian people. But no, he's not going to wake up on a Tuesday morning and just pull his forces out of
Ukraine. Since you brought up Korea, all of that dynasty inherited their sunk costs. Will the next Russian say, that was a disaster, I want to get back into Europe, cut and dump those costs and withdraw from Ukraine? What do you think of the possibility of that?
From your lips to God's ears. And I think it is a realistic possibility. The kleptocracy around Putin will collapse alongside with him. And I think that is every possibility of the Hewitt solution.
A happy 4th of July to you, Admiral Stavridis. Have a great one. You certainly have earned it through all your years. Retired former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO and of Southern Command. Putting a period on the week that the West had, which was a good one, just like the Constitution. I'll be right back, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. 2 years and 1 month ago, George Floyd was murdered in Minnesota, sparking the worst race-related violence in the United States since the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, which I covered as a young reporter for KCET. Shelby Steele has been watching this all for many, many years. He is the Robert Marion Oster Professor, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, prolific, profound observer on race in America for over 50 years. He is the recipient of the National Medal for the Humanities, best known perhaps for his 1998 book, The Content of Our Character, his 2006 book, White Guilt, How Blacks and Whites Together Destroyed the Promise of the Civil Rights Era. I wanted to talk to him as the Supreme Court leaves town. They will begin work on an affirmative action case for next fall. Dr. Steele, welcome. It's great to have you.
Well, it's good to be here.
Now, talk to me a little bit about where you think the United States is in this summer of 2022 on matters of race generally, Black America specifically, and the affirmative action case, which is coming right at the court at high speed.
Okay. Well, you know, the reality, here's the larger reality, I think. The problem of racism in American life is over with. We conquered racism. I date it to 1964 Civil Rights Bill, Civil Rights Act. And here is this great country acknowledging it's wrong, saying it's against the law to discriminate against American citizens on the basis of race. What an achievement. What we did not take into account is that at that moment, Black America was entering for the very first time freedom. Our problem is not racism. Our problem is freedom. 400 years of oppression will sort of undermine your ability to handle freedom. You don't know anything about it. You know about everything else, but you don't know about freedom. And what it takes, and the sort of value systems, and the reliance on institutions like the family and so forth that are so important in developing individuals who can function freely in a free society and be successful, be competitive with other people. We missed all that. And so the moment we became free, we entered decline. And we've been declining relentlessly since the mid-60s with an abundance of government programs the larger societies sort of going out of its way constantly to indicate that it's not racist anymore. And we keep ignoring the problem of freedom.
Dr. Steele, over a decade ago, Chief Justice Roberts in the Seattle School District case wrote a line, which I think people just ought to memorize: the way to end discrimination on the basis of race is to end discriminating on the basis of race. And he struck it down. But it didn't stick. Yeah. It did not stick. We are still doing it almost everywhere in almost every area of society. And I don't see any way out. Do you?
Well, I do. I mean, I know what the way out is. The problem is white guilt. And we've not fully brought that to the forefront and looked at it to this point. But again, 4 centuries of practicing evil on another group of human beings, you don't just say, I'm sorry, and walk away from that. You carry with you vulnerabilities. People can, I can, as a Black, I can use that in any number of situations to give myself an advantage. And that's what whites are simply in that position of not having enough moral authority to enforce the values and the principles that make America great, that make America a free society, because they betrayed them for 4 centuries. And so now, Mike, we hold that, we have that as a weapon in this war. And it seems to me that's where we've tried everything else. American liberalism for 60 years now, everything, affirmative actions, on and on. And we keep wondering why none of it ever works. Whites have got to get to the point where they say, listen, what we did was profoundly wrong. And that makes the point. We want to end it here. But we are not going to be intimidated away from the values that make us strong, make us a great free nation.
So how does that
end up and hold the ground of American society, then we'll begin to get past the problem. Blacks will then have to take responsibility for dealing with their actual problem, which is freedom.
You know, Dr. Steele, I was in California when that argument was asked and answered with, I think it's Prop 209, Ward Carroll, and all of the public universities and public institutions in California were forbidden to consult race in the making of decisions based on merit. It did matter. It does not matter. It still comes in. What you push out through the front door, it comes in through the back door because bureaucrats want to use it. And I really am at a loss for a way forward. You can banish it. It's unconstitutional. I've cited the Supreme Court. I've cited an initiative in California. I know the morals of using race are wrong, but I do not know how to get race out of the American water. It's in our water.
It's poison. Race is absolutely always, in every circumstance, poison. And it's poisoning America. And you are absolutely right. I can look in, I can say, whites, we need more courage. We need resistance to this sort of placating blacks. At this point, blacks are not even demanding much. It's the bureaucracies and American institutions and so forth that are this slow, steady march of eroding the values, of undermining merit, for example. You know, think of this poor woman Brown, who is lifted to the Supreme Court, but Biden says he's picking only black women. What a horrible thing to do. It basically says merit does not count. Politics counts. It erodes our democracy. And we keep doing that. We've done that in the university system. Eroded merit in academia. And we're eroding merit in almost every institution of American life. Because we're trying to get away from that stigma of racism.
If you can't measure merit, you can't use merit. I recall when George H.W. Bush nominated Clarence Thomas, and he stood by the argument, and I knew it to be true because I knew the justice back when he was running the EEOC before he went on the D.C. Circuit, that he was the most qualified man in America. Sure enough, he's shown that. He has stood his ground, and he has argued his case for the originalist understanding just as long as Scalia did, and maybe with more lasting impact. But nobody believed George H.W. Bush. Now that President Biden actually says he's picking a candidate based on race, it became a third rail to talk about. I honestly do not know the way forward at this point, Dr. Steele. What do you recommend my audience read, think, listen to, or about in order to move forward?
Well, I've written a couple books.
There you go. I think the content of our character is crucial, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I agree with you. I can't sit here and give a glib answer to what we need to. It humbles me, the way American life so slowly unfolds. You think you understand it, but you're missing something and something else pops up. And that's what's happening here. Our understanding, for example, that blacks could use their victimization as power. Nobody really knew that back in the 50s, before the 60s began to unfold. Today, it's common knowledge. I presume we'll continue to grow and learn in that way. Slowly, probably painfully. We seem to have a long way to go, and I offer the answer of courage because I simply do not see anything else. There is no bureaucratic maneuver that is going to get us around this problem. We have to stand for something. And white America, okay, you did a profoundly courageous thing in the 60s when you acknowledged America's culpability. Now you have to support the traditional values of American life and apply them to everybody.
So yeah, courage is
to benefit from them.
That's an interesting answer, Dr. Steele. Courage is the most important virtue because it is the virtue upon which all others depend. And so it will require the courage to speak for merit. I don't know that anyone's going to do that. I don't know if American politics, and largely because legacy media hates the concept of merit, but it's a, do you see it at Stanford? Do you see it there? Is merit making a comeback anywhere?
No, not at Stanford. I don't see that happening anywhere at this moment in all of academia. It's sort of lost this idea. It continues this to suffer under this illusion that you can use race in a positive way, do good things with it. We still have not yet learned or accepted that you can never, ever use race at all for anything. It is poison. You have to think of it as poison. It'll get you one way or another. It will erode values. It will erode merit. Look at what it's doing in universities. It just erodes these things in the name of the good. Racism always comes to the fore. It's always used in the name of the good. We're going to make it a better world. No, you're not. You're going to deepen the evil. And America is the testing ground for this. We're a million miles ahead of any other country. This idea of taking democracy past the barrier of race, that is, it seems to me, the American challenge at the moment.
I think that is exactly and perfectly put, Dr. Steele. Thank you for that. I hope you write a book on merit. I know you've written a lot of books and you probably don't want to write any more books, but I hope you write a book on merit because I think you just succinctly stated the problem and the solution. And it's right in front of us. Shelby Steele, thank you for joining me early in the morning in California time. I appreciate your time very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Dr. Shelby Steele, the author of, among other things, The Content of Our Character. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Overnight, our great ally, the State of Israel, changed prime minister. Joining me to discuss that is Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister in the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. Mr. Lapid is now Prime Minister Lapid. What do we make of that? Does it matter for the next few months until Israel votes on November 1st, Michael Oren?
Well, it matters indeed. When Lapid and Bennett got together and made this national unity government, there was a provision that if the government was going to fall and Israel was going to go to elections, that Lapid would then come in as an interim prime minister. Otherwise, he would have come in another year. Why? Because he wants to run in the election as prime minister, which is a huge advantage. For anybody in an election. And if you're the incumbent. And he gets to meet with President Biden next week and shake hands with a lot of world leaders. I understand his schedule is completely filled with meeting world leaders. He wants those photo ops one after another. And he's got to hope that there's no truly fatal decisions coming up, like with Iran, for example, that would challenge his leadership ability.
Dr. Oren, what is inflation in Israel right now?
Low.
You see, you're the only state in the world that seems to have low inflation. Ordinarily,
incumbent high to begin with. Okay.
Most elections in America are decided on the economy, as you know. Is the economy healthy in Israel right now?
If the economy is healthy, and it's not. Israel's GDP has surpassed that of Italy, Japan, and even Germany. Amazing, the average GDP in this country, and yet the prices are, through the roof, and literally through the roof. The housing prices went up 13% last year, 16% this year, and I am now in the most expensive city on earth, Tel Aviv.
Well, that tells me that things won't go well for an incumbent. Now, talk to me generally about the election. It's a four-month cycle. The vote is on November 1st. I read the Israeli polls. They're worse than the American polls, if you ask me.
Bibi's looking good. Netanyahu is coming out in front, and he's smiling. It's the big issue here, Hugh, is not necessarily whether Netanyahu can win or not, because it's pretty sure that he is still the most popular singular politician in Israel. He's the politician which the majority of Israelis believe is most qualified to be prime minister. That's not the issue. The issue is whether he can cobble together a coalition with party heads who don't like him and refuse to sit with him. That's the huge issue. It's been the issue for years now. And by the way, P.S., the economy is a major theme of Israeli politics, but it's not the major theme. The major theme is security.
And how does Lapid stack up on security?
Not great. I quote one of my kids. I won't name him, okay? And my kids are generally center, even center left. And when my child learned that Lapid was going to be prime minister, the expression was, oh, no, don't trust him. He doesn't have any real positions. He doesn't have a real backbone. He's an empty suit.
Wow. Now, Michael Oren, let's reset this. Israel votes. They vote parliamentary style. You got to get 61 people to sit in your coalition. Am I wrong to think that maybe it's the best thing that ever happened to Benjamin Netanyahu's longevity is that he got bumped out for a year so that Israel could say, okay, we're not wedded to Netanyahu, but we want him back?
That's so interesting. You know, I just landed at the airport. I'm in a cab. I'm talking to the cab driver. It's very important to talk to cab drivers.
Yep.
They're the most politically savvy people. So Shai tells me here that he's willing to vote for Netanyahu, not because he loves Netanyahu, because he wants stability. And he's tired of all the elections and the inability of Israeli government to get it together and make decisions. I think that there is now kind of a certain amount of BB nostalgia. Because if you didn't like him personally, if you didn't like the fact that he had all these corruption charges against him, he was stable, and he brought stability to the country, and he made people think that their children could be safe sleeping at night, and that's his great, great advantage.
So the last 14 months plus the next 4 months will be not Bibi prime minister, and I think a lot of voters will say, okay, we showed him, we're in charge, but now we're going to bring him back.
Yeah, or, you know, Lapid could do very well as prime minister, and he could do what Bennett did. Bennett did for certain of Israeli, certainly for the international community. Boy, they loved him. The New York Times loved him. This is a man who was radical rightist, all of a sudden becomes the beloved of the New York Times because he made the impression that he actually could be a prime minister. That same child of mine who was worried about Yair Lapid said that would Bennett form his own party? My kid would support him.
Now, Yamina has now got a new leader. Is that new leader likely to sit with Netanyahu in a coalition?
Well, now you've put your finger on. That's a big question. The new head of the Yamina is Ayala Chiket, a very competent person, very charismatic, a veteran politician in this country. But there's the but. First of all, she sat in Bennett's party, which sat with left-wing parties and an Arab party, and that burned many bridges between her and her right-wing base. They don't trust her anymore. So the big question is there a center-center-right party that is willing to sit with Bibi? That's the whole issue of this election. Why? Because there are a number of center-right parties, but the head of those parties won't sit with Bibi. So in order to cobble together the coalition, he needs a party that's going to take votes not from Likud, but from Yair Lapid, and then sit with him.
And that might be Yamina. Dr. Michael Oren will be checking in. 4 months of campaigning ahead in Israel, and we've got the best expert for an American audience, Dr. Michael Oren. Follow him on Twitter at @drmichaeloren. Follow me the next hour on the July 1 show as we go to the Hillsdale Dialogue. Dr. Larry Oren, part 3 of our series on Aristotle's Ethics to get you into the long weekend. Stay tuned.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.